I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Friday Golf Podcast. I am your host, Andy Johnson, and I am joined, as always, on Tuesdays with Joseph LaMagna. Joseph, I feel like I haven't talked to you on this for a while.
Yeah, it's been a minute. This is a good era of golf. It was a sneaky, exciting weekend for both the men's and the women's side, so I'm excited to talk to you.
I got back from the Masters, and it's just like, you're kind of swamped and you're ready for a weekend at home. And the last thing you want to do is tell your loved ones that you need to watch golf. But that's what I found myself doing, because I was like, you know, history is happening this weekend. And my wife was just like, why? And I said, to explain what's going on. I don't think it really made a difference. She was kind of threw her hands up. That's the crazy thing about what's going on in golf right now.
Yeah, similarly, I had some family in town this weekend, and I was watching the PGA Tour event, and then when that went off during weather delay, they're like, all right, so are you free now? I was like, actually, I need to be pretty plugged into the women's golf too, so I can empathize.
All right, let's do in and out. What are you in on?
In a similar vein, Andy, I am in on the golf course storylines that we have now in professional golf, and that entering each tournament on both the men's and the women's side, the pre-tournament press conferences, like when they're sitting there, Scottie Scheffler knows he's the best player in the world and the target's kind of on his back. He is the standard. Nelly Korda knows she's the best women's player in the world. The target's on her back. She's the standard. And it's a dynamic we haven't really had in either sport, I would say, since, at least 15, 20 years, right? Rory's gone through really good stretches on the men's side. Jason Day was really good in 2015, but we haven't seen this level of dominance like we've seen from Scottie Scheffler. And then Nelly Korda's won 5 tournaments in a row. Like, we have this dynamic on both the men's and the women's side, and I think that's a really exciting way to frame the rest of 2024.
Yeah, I'm in on the same thing. I called it dominant players. I am in on dominant players. We haven't, as you mentioned, I don't think we've seen this type of dominance since Tiger Woods. We'll see how long they can sustain it. I think that's the big question. But it frames everything so well. The opening storyline of any tournament that Scottie Scheffler plays in is he going to win, or can anybody beat him? Can anyone beat him? Right now, we've just watched him win an elevated or 2 or 3 signature events, if you include the players in that, and a major championship, and only was beat by his Steven Yeager. And it took a short miss to do that, like 2 short misses. Scotty kind of fumbled that one. On the women's side, it's the same thing. You've got Nelly Korda. And I think what's so fascinating is, 6 weeks ago on this podcast, we were wondering, where were the stars? The LPGA was just getting their season kicked off, but on the PGA Tour, it was like, where are the stars at? Look at this crappy list of winners. And now 5 weeks later, it's like, oh, well, we've got a dominant player that has reached a level that we haven't seen since Tiger, like a level in the stratosphere of Tiger Woods, which is extraordinary, an extraordinary achievement. I guess we'll get to this in our next segment, but I don't know if it's going to slow down or what would cause it to slow down. It feels pretty sustainable on the Scheffler side. On the Nelly side, I think she's obviously established herself as the number one player in the world. And who knows? She's going for 6 this week at Wilshire.
One feeling I've had, especially when watching Scottie, and then it felt similar with Nelly. If somebody's up 3 shots with 5 or 6 holes to play, it's often felt like the tournament isn't over, right? Like we've seen crazy things happen that lead can be caught. With Scottie Scheffler right now, when he's up 3 with 5 to play, it feels completely over. And I'm sure you could say the same of Nelly Korda. Have you been feeling that way? Much like it feels different than other eras in history when another player is up 3 with 6, you know, 5-6 holes to play.
This sounds crazy, but Scottie chipped in on number 2 yesterday and went up 3, and I was like, "That's over."
Yeah, it's crazy.
He just does not give shots away. The short game, I think both of them, when you look at, they both are very, very good tee to green players, extraordinary tee to green players. But both of them, I think the winning recipe is they both are ultra, ultra elite short game players. Nelly's one of the best on the LPGA Tour. Scottie's one of the best on the PGA Tour. And I mean, when you pair a great short game with, you know, in Scottie's case, historic levels of ball striking, it's just extremely hard to beat. I mean, he was an awful putter last year. Awful. He was awful. Like one of the worst on the PGA Tour last year. And he didn't finish outside the top 10 for like months.
It's crazy.
So what are you out on?
Andy, I am fully out on the Zurich Classic this week getting FedEx Cup points. I think this is a true travesty.
Your guy Paresh is back.
Paresh is not back, but
he isn't.
Russ Cochran is in the field. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, he's going to get a 600 start. He's the he's playing with Eric Cole. I heard about this actually Riviera week when I was walking with Eric Cole and Nick Hardy. And
right, I believe it's Eric Cole's caddy's father, if yes. I'm not mistaken.
So he's,
I mean, not
he's
a competitive
get a 600 start.
He's not a competitive golfer, right? He plays on the Champions Tour. He's 65. He's not competitive on the Champions Tour. It is crazy. I mean, we make fun of FedEx Cup points, but it's really an indictment of the system. The points are important. This defines players' careers and the opportunities that they have. It's crazy to me that you could just get an unbelievable partner. You could be a mediocre tour player, play with Scottie in this event. If you win, You are securing
your future.
You
get a 2-year exemption.
It's crazy. Yes, there's the exemption. It could move you into the top 50 of the FedEx Cup points list, which ultimately is what gets you into all the signature events. Like I know that the points aren't as high as at signature events, but there shouldn't be points for this at all. It's crazy. I'm all for a variety of formats, but the Zurich Classic getting FedEx Cup points is an embarrassment.
I feel like we need a counter on how many times you're out revolves around the FedEx Cup in a given year.
It should be. Like, this is the currency of the tour, and this is what defines which events you're playing in. It's a massive deal. It'd be like saying, you know, certain regular season events in the NFL only get a half a win or something. Like, if they were doing stuff like that, it'd be a massive story. How guys get their status on tour is extremely important.
Yeah, I guess I don't feel as strongly. I think that this event started as like a good intentioned, different event that was a breath of fresh air when it came out 5 or 6 years ago, however long it was ago. It was like, thank God we don't have all the, but then came the implications of it. Like the OWGR immediately was like, we're not awarding world ranking points to the winner. We're not awarding world ranking points for this thing. And then it's like, we're just going to make it the same. And at the time when this came out, there was no signature events. There were a few opposite field events, but to me, like maybe it's a discounted amount of FedEx Cup points, but it can't carry all the same benefits. Like you can't get a 2-year exemption out of this, you know, like, you think about like what goes into earning a card. If you are an amateur, say Ludwig, what he did to earn his card. I guess he won it because of PGA Tour U, but let's go back to Jon Rahm. The year that Jon Rahm put together Turning Pro to earn a card is insane. To me, it's also insane that somebody could just partner up and their partner could go absolutely bananas, like could shoot 62, 62, be out of his mind. And, you know, if it was an individual event, would win by 10. And this person just tagged along and got a card. Like, that's crazy to me. You could literally freeload your way to a card.
Crazy. I mean, Alex Fitzpatrick's a great example, and this was depicted in Full Swing, the season two of Full Swing. Alex Fitzpatrick, brother of Matt Fitzpatrick, is playing with Matt this week. Like, that
very
is
very good
enormous...
player also.
He's a good player, absolutely, but it's an enormous benefit to tee it up with your brother, who's a world-class player, and he could help you earn the opportunity to have status on tour. And to be clear, this is an I'm making this point in the same vein as some of being disgusted with some sponsor exemptions that have happened. It's the same argument. Like, you're just handing people a pretty unfair I want to use that word carefully, but pretty unfair advantage to securing their status on tour just based on who they know, who they're teeing it up with. I'm really out on that.
Yeah. So if they finished like second, Alex Fitzpatrick would basically just have to like make a couple cuts and he would earn a card.
What if they win? Like, he's really securing his future, and it just feels
then
crazy.
Then he might be in designated events.
So yeah, that's what I'm out on. What are you out on, Andy?
I'm just out on the overall golf schedule. I think that as we look at the reform of the PGA Tour, the potential for this deal that who knows what's going on with this deal, but you know, if the potential for the men's tour to come back together, could we just get some collaboration? Can we get all the tours in the room together? Can we get the LPGA, the PGA Tour, and can we get it set up so that like we're not running an LPGA major concurrent with a designated event? Like, to me, that doesn't ever need to happen. Majors never have to coincide. Big events from either tour never have to coincide. There's enough weeks in the year. If we just did a little planning, put the stuff on paper together, we wouldn't run into the situation where we have Scotty and Nelly and people are having to choose. Like, it would have been really great if and I don't think the Heritage should be an elevated event the week after a major. But if that Heritage got pushed back one more week and it was a week off, the PGA Tour is off, and Nelly, the first women's major, is coming right after the Masters. That's great for golf. That's great for the overarching growth of golf as a whole. You know, that puts the women on a stage that they, you know, maybe they get more cameras. Maybe their broadcast is a little bit better. There's more of a broadcast window because of this. But we need all these tours. I know this is kind of probably a crazy thought, given where we're at right now. We need the PGA Tour and LIV to somehow coexist and co-mingle, however it may be. But then we need some communication with the other tours so that we don't have majors and huge events coinciding at the same time, because all it's doing is splitting the golf audience up and making them choose.
I agree with you, Andy. I don't think it's just the labeling signature, the prestige of certain events. There's also could be some time zone staggering too, if you planned it out, right? Like, well, this one's on the West Coast, and so we stagger the TV viewing windows a little bit. One point that was made to me, I'll shout out ex-user Steve Caimano. Andy, I'm curious if you've thought about this, but one thing he responded to me on a tweet with, it's interesting that golf has a unique challenge that the people who watch the sport play the sport, which we talk about all the time, right? That's yes. Part of the appeal of golf. Not only are you stacking multiple events against each other, like the LPGA Tour event against the PGA Tour event this week, you're also stacking it against the time that you're fans play the sport, the middle of a Sunday afternoon, which is a unique dynamic that I hadn't really thought about that much. I mean, it sounds obvious, but I think it's a practical consideration that only lends more credence to the idea that putting things on different time zones, like West Coast, when it's nighttime for a lot of people in America and they're not going to be playing golf, I think it only highlights the importance of that.
You know, everybody talks about how we grow the game, how we grow viewership, but nobody wants to talk about, oh, like, we should be playing in prime time. We should not be playing here. And I think that's like the especially, I mean, you talk about like when PGA Tour interest wanes, it's the middle of the summer. And why? Because it's like, well, I live most of my life in Chicago. I want to be outside. I don't want to be inside watching golf. So why don't we figure out how we can put golf on when people are inside, when there's no competition? I could be sitting outside grilling dinner with golf on the TV. That's a lot better than 2 p.m. on a Saturday or 2 p.m. on a Sunday when I want to be doing other stuff.
And I guess the other point on
that, I want to make this point. It would make my life worse because that'd be more late night podcasting for me, which I don't like
doing. Very selfless of you. I think the other point, though, like, technology breeds innovation, right? Huge innovation over the last couple of years is multi-screening. And you can make the argument that, hey, PGA Tour doesn't want to compete with the NBA playoffs or doesn't want to compete with a lot of the NFL products. We live in a multi-screen world now where I can have on the big screen maybe an NBA playoff game and ideally like also an LPGA Tour event or also a PGA Tour event. And when the NBA game turns into a blowout, like people unmute the golf and like that's what they start to focus on. Like I think the multi-screen world really enables not having to compete as much with like the NBA playoffs or NCAA March Madness. Like there should be a little bit more appetite for competing with those products.
I think we're probably about 3 years away from the PGA Tour acknowledging that multi-screen exists. Just personal estimate. All right. Before we get to our questions, we're doing a little exercise. We're going to do questions heading into the rest of the majors, kind of like the looming questions now that we're one major in men's pro golf. And then we were joined by Meg Atkins later for a discussion around Nelly and her historic win. But before we get there, hey, Joseph, do you know what rangefinder is trusted by 98.6% of PGA Tour players? Do you know which
one? Andy, I don't even have a rangefinder, but I'm pretty sure I know it's Bushnell.
It is Bushnell. It's precision perfected, next level performance. And now with the new Bushnell Golf Pro X3 Plus, it also gauges the wind. I think this is a pretty cool tool. I grew up caddying. One of the things I learned from a young age was how to figure out wind. But one of the things that I noticed with a lot of players that they just don't understand how to compute wind. A lot of times they underestimate it, don't understand what a quartering wind might do. Now you have a rangefinder that's going to help you do this. So wind speed and direction is shown on the display. And if you connect this to your Bushnell Golf mobile app, it will get that up-to-date wind data and actually will, you know, calculate it for you. A lot of Bushnell, the modern ones, I remember my first Bushnell. This was back in like the mid-2000s. You're too young for this, but it was big and wide. It was like a pair of binoculars. And now they're so small, it's kind of like amazing. But they're waterproof. They've got the magnetic mount that is easy if you ride in a cart to go on there. And it is definitely the best at locking to a pin. So that's always the tricky thing. Sometimes I've found myself with the rangefinder overclubbing myself because I catch, you know, maybe the trees in the background, not the flag. Not with Bushnell. They're great at locking to those pins. So if you want to find out more about the new Pro X3 Plus, visit bushnellgolf.com. All right, Joseph, we're one major in, and I thought a interesting topic would be kind of questions heading into the big looming questions heading into the next three majors. They're coming really fast. It's an early US Open paired with a late Masters. This run we're going to be on, we're going to blink and it's going to be Open Championship time. And I think like just kind of setting the table, talking about some of the big looming questions is a good exercise. You know, otherwise we could get into like our favorite teams on Zurich, but I thought this might be a more interesting topic. So what's a question that's been kind of rattling around in your brain?
To me, Scottie Scheffler is the ultimate litmus test of like how much variance is there in golf, because the smart side to take of bets is always like not overreacting, right? How many majors is this player going to win? We throw out a number. The smart thing to do is generally to take the under. And I think Scotty is the ultimate example where the way his game is built feels so variance proof, and he's showing it week in and week out. So my question, do you think it's more likely or not that Scotty Scheffler wins another major in 2024? Your feet to the fire. Does he win one of the next three?
I'm going to say yes, he is. And this was my big question is, can he get two major championships this year or more? Because we have had a lot of years where we've had, you know, one major championship. It's not often we get a guy that wins two major championships in a year.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think if you do this question, if you do this exercise every year with whoever the hottest player is, like you always take the under here. So I'm almost inclined, like I know there's a side of my brain that's saying like take the under here, but I also think he does win one of the next three.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing about him is that he just sets up so well to all courses.
You see the, I don't know if you saw the tweet from Sean Martin. Scotty Scheffler now is the first player in the history of the PGA Tour to win at Harbortown, Bay Hill, Sawgrass, and Augusta. So to your point, right? Like he's been, a lot of different tests have been thrown at him and he just keeps passing them.
I mean, think about this run. Think about the run that we've just gone on with him. So he's got four wins and a runner-up. And the runner-up was like, he kind of probably feels like he kicked that tournament away. Didn't play great on Sunday. On that run, you have Arnold Palmer. Narrow fairway, thick rough. You know, you could probably liken it to your like traditional, your father's U.S. Open setup.
Where,
yeah, it's like kind of like, almost a bit gimmicky with how it's set up, you know, and it's just you miss the fairway. I mean, this is the thing. It's like I remember watching yesterday. It's through 12 and it's like he misses the fairway. He hits the fairway. It just sneaks in. And they're like, oh, yeah, he's only missed one fairway today. And it was about by a foot. You know, it's like he drives it so freaking straight and he has a lot of power and he drives it so straight. But anyway, so he wins at API. Then he wins at Sawgrass, a golf course that is very positional, takes driver out of your hands a good amount. You have to have like elite approach play. If you miss greens, it's a really big short game test. There's
crushes
trouble everywhere.
Yep. Yeah.
There's trouble, like big numbers everywhere. So he wins there. Then he goes to Texas, which is a Tom Doak design. It is. You know, not a lot of bunkers, you know, short rough, like you could hit it a lot of places, but the angles are super important. It's a very strategic golf course. Like we saw it, like, and he finishes second, he loses to one person and it's because of some short putting. Then we go to the Masters. He wins at Augusta National, you know, super hilly, wider fairways. Again, a place where you can, I think, like, you know, short game's obviously big there. We've talked about Augusta a ton. A place you have to do everywhere. It's super firm and fast. That's the other thing. So it's super firm and fast at Augusta. It's soft and wet at TPC Sawgrass. And now he wins Harbortown, a golf course that literally takes away one of his strongest suits, his driver, for the most part, and levels the field there. So you take away one of his biggest, you know, biggest advantages on most courses. You mitigate that down and he runs away with this one.
And Andy, I think one thing that will be lost in history a little bit as we look back on this run, the Harbortown win, and I know we've talked about this a little bit, I've seen it on social media, part of why it is almost as impressive to me as any of the other wins, like the Augusta win was extremely physically and mentally taxing. So for Scotty Scheffler to go through like a windy championship setup, like you have the Masters, you're leading the whole time, that's an exhausting experience. To then just show up at Harbortown after expending all of that energy, totally different golf course, not get off to a hot start, and then just turn around and win dominantly, like it's a different brand of dominance.
It is I mean, like that's the thing that we haven't ever seen. We've had these big events occasionally after majors the last few years. No time has any major champion win the week before come back and really even contend. Like last year, Jon Rahm was doing broadcast in the booth while the leaders were finishing. That's, you know, he finished whatever 40th. I remember when Phil played, what did he play? Colonial, maybe the week after the PGA.
Yeah, missed the cut.
I think he made the cut, but maybe he missed the cut. But yeah, like
it was,
usually
it looked bad, whatever it was.
Usually these people don't play. They don't play. They're hardly in the tournament. They play and they're just there. They aren't dominating. Like this thing felt over almost on Saturday when he cruised up to the top of the board.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Andy, do you feel like Scottie's elevating the sport right now? Because I've almost felt like it kind of sparked my imagination a little bit when you were talking about some of the post Masters press conferences or quick quotes and some of the players talking about just acknowledging Scottie's better than they are. I almost felt a little bit like this week at the RBC Heritage, like Scottie is bringing a little bit of other players' bests out, like maybe Colin Morikawa in particular, by setting that standard. This could have been a really sleepy week, but I feel like some guys maybe brought it a little more because Scottie's kind of showing like this is the standard now. Do you feel that way?
I think so. I think there's still the next step is fan interest with Scottie. And I don't think it's all the way there. And I've kind of been thinking about this for a little while. Like, why is the fan interest not there? Everybody says he's boring. And something that I've kind of like centered on is I think that we saw Tiger. Tiger was this like universal, pretty universal. I know there were some Tiger detractors, but fairly universally loved athlete that really brought golf to a different level. And then there was this era of heir apparents, and they became super popular. Rory and Jordan Spieth are two of the most popular players, and they're still relevant players playing in their primes of their career. They're uber popular. And I think what happens is that like people have become big Rory and Jordan fans. Those are two huge, huge like stars in terms of fan interest. And what's happened is like Scottie doesn't attract fan interest because he's not Rory or Jordan. Does that make sense? Do you think I'm thinking about this in a way? And like people don't like Scottie because he's beating their guys.
Or that they haven't converted to being like a Rory fan into being a Scottie fan.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't thought about it that way. I think there's, you know, probably a whole podcast we could do because I've been thinking a lot about why isn't Scottie more popular. I do think there's something to the way he answers questions in press conferences, which I like. And it's representative of his identity and kind of downplaying. He's very process driven, not as much results driven, when a lot of people might prefer if he was like, you know, if he wrapped his identity a little bit more in golf, that might attract more people. I think that's also happening. I think there's a lot of reasons maybe he's not resonating as much, but for hardcore golf fans, I do think I don't want to say he should be resonating, but at least for me, he resonates because he's excellent in every facet of the game and is showing that dominance with his mentality. And I think dominance with a strong golf mentality isn't the most marketable trait of a player. Like, saying that there's only certain things that are within your control, like that's not the most sexy argument to make from behind the microphone.
And that's like, compare that to Tiger, who was like, oh, right, I came here to win. Anything but winning is not acceptable.
I think there's a little bit of that happening.
He's so dominant. And I think like he hasn't said anything that should like detract people. But I do sense that there is like this world of people that don't love him as, you know, golf superstar.
He keeps it simple, and simplicity isn't super captivating, right, Andy? Like, it'd be more fun if there were more layers to his life and off the course drama that people could sink their teeth into. And I just don't think there's going to be that.
All right. My next kind of big question is an obvious one. We could be getting to 10 years of no majors for Rory McIlroy. So can Rory bag one of these? I think he's not playing the best golf. And that's not the best thing for a truncated major season where everything comes at you fast. That being said, he's playing a lot, but can Rory bag a major, and what's his best chance?
So I think people have been almost borderline a little disrespectful about Rory's game and the way we've talked about 2024 and even some majors in 2023, there basically hasn't been a better player in majors over the past 10 years, like more consistent. Sure, he's not, hasn't won them like Brooks Koepka, hasn't won them like Scotty, but Rory's been very good in major championships. I picked him before the year started to win at Valhalla, and I think that's clearly his best chance. That golf course sets up very well for him. I have concerns about Pinehurst and Troon and the way that those could potentially set up. So I think, is Rory going to win a major this year? It's much more likely than not that he doesn't, but I think there's a very strong chance he's in the mix of Valhalla.
Why does Valhalla set up well, and why do you have concerns about Pinehurst or Troon?
So I think with Rory, I mean, we always talk about him as being such a great driver of the golf ball, but I do think sometimes his accuracy gets overstated a little bit and that he does spray some tee shots. And when you get on golf courses where a narrow miss versus a wide miss, there's not that big of a difference. Like Oak Hill is a great example last year, where if you're just a little bit off the fairway, there wasn't a significantly different penalty than if you got way off the fairway. And you actually see this with a lot of these typically older tree-lined courses where the only defense is rough and there's not, you know, like out of bounds or some other penalty if you're wider off the fairway. That's kind of what Valhalla sets up. Like, it kind of reminds me, Andy, of Crooked Stick, which is a course I'm super familiar with, where Rory won the BMW in 2012. Dustin Johnson won the BMW there in 2016. And John Daly famously won the PGA there in 1991. I think looking at that golf course and as kind of understanding how that can benefit guys who have a lot of power but aren't necessarily the most accurate, Valhalla reminds me a lot of that. And so I think it sets up well for Rory. Pinehurst and Troon, I think Rory sometimes has issues in the wind, which can be a problem at an open championship. And then some of these wide misses that kind of get him into some hairy locations, like he might find himself at Pinehurst. So I think Valhalla is pretty clearly the best course fit.
All right. What's your next question?
So typically, Andy, we get, I was just looking through some historical data. We typically get 1 to 3 players who finish in the top 20 of all 4 majors each year. So more often it's 1 than it is 3, but let's say one or two players are probably going to finish in the top 20 in all 4 majors this year. Remove Scotty. Which player do you have the most confidence that they'll finish in the top 20 in all 4 majors? And you can't, obviously we've already had the Masters. So like Rahm and Rory didn't finish in the top 20. So those names aren't in consideration.
Brooks didn't either.
Right.
Right.
Right. Brooks.
So I have this as one of my questions, and I think there's 2 names that jump up to me. Will Zalatoris and Ludvig.
Interesting. There's 2 names for me too, and only one of those. I think Xander is in the mix there too.
Okay, so Xander, who's your other?
Xander and Ludvig are my 2 names. I love Zalatoris for majors too, so maybe we should be considering all 3. But if you had to pick one of those, I guess, who do you have the most confidence in?
I think it's Ludvig. And my question regarding this is, like, where on the list of favorites does Ludvig fall going forward? I think, like, he was like a second page guy going into the Masters. It's like, who knows? It's his first major ever. Is he a top 5 pick in the majors now? Is he top 5 without a doubt?
For me, he's top 5 without a doubt. I think it's Scotty, big jump, and then Rory, Rahm, Brooks, and Ludvig.
That's where I kind of, I mean, like, think about that. Think about that. Think about it at the beginning of the year, or even at the end of the Open last year, saying Ludvig was going to be your number 5 after those 4. It's banana land, but I think we're here. He's so good. It's crazy. I think just the way he drives the golf ball just sets everything up. You can't play really bad the way he drives the ball.
He reminds me of Rahm. Does he remind you of Rahm at all? I feel like the off the tee play and that consistent, it's long and it's straight and he's putting himself in prime position over and over again, reminds me of a John Rahm that we've seen, maybe not as much in 2024, but a John Rahm we've seen over the last 5 years who's had very consistent results at major championships. I kind of get that same feeling from Ludvig.
Yeah, and I think, like, I agree somewhat to that. I think he's got a little bit more horsepower than Rahm. I'm not positive. I don't think he's as good of an iron player as Rahm was. But at the same time, you know, to me, at the Masters, it was just clear there was only one guy that could stand up to Scotty. that had the game to really challenge him, and it was him.
It's fascinating we're already there, but I think we're there. Maybe he not played, to where he's the only player who can stand up, but he's one of the few.
I mean, he played great at Harbortown too, a golf course that, you know, you would think would be a big challenge for him, taking a lot of drivers out of his hands. Didn't matter.
He's also a really good putter, Andy. I think it's going under the radar a little bit. Like, Ludvig's a very good putter so far.
I think just getting his, if he could get his short game to a plus, it would go a long way.
Absolutely. You know? Should I get to one of my questions?
Yeah, sure.
Or did I just do one? Or I guess it was both of ours.
Kind of both. I'll go with one here. By the PGA Championship, Xander Schauffele will have spent as many weeks inside the top 10 of the OWGR as Jordan Spieth. Cantlay is not very far behind. They've passed Ricky Fowler's weeks in the top 10. They've passed Luke Donald. They are without a doubt the two best players to not win a major that are active and playing. I'm not counting Lee Westwood. They're up into the 250s of weeks into the top in the top 10. Just to give you context, they're 3 years away from catching Colin Montgomery. And it's not out of this world. But do either of these guys, who has the better chance? Who's the better player? And will one of them win a major, or are they going to go their career without winning one?
To be honest, Andy, I've always leaned a little bit thinking Xander Schauffele is a slightly better golfer, which has aged well at times and not as well at other times. I think Xander Schauffele is a legitimate threat to win major championships. He's kind of had this increase in speed this year that's gone under the radar, but I mean, he's a very well-rounded golfer that's been in the mix a lot in major championships and has won non-majors. He gets a bad rap for not being able to close. I think Xander Schauffele is a legitimate threat, not a top five name. Not sure I really believe that he's going to win, but I think he's a legit threat. I'm at the point where I don't really believe Patrick Cantlay is a huge threat to win major championships, and you have to take stands somewhere. It'd be nice to just say every player has a chance. Obviously, Cantlay has a chance, but I'm kind of lower on him and don't really believe that he's going to be in the mix at a major. So I'll say Xander probably picks off a major in the next 5 years, and Cantlay is not. Where are you?
I would probably put my... Why is it that... Is there something about Patrick Cantlay's game that doesn't work in majors?
You know, I believe a little more and more, Andy, and some people like not being able to step up and play in majors. And that's an idea I kind of was dismissive of for a while. And I think there might be something mental with Cantlay. I know some people have gotten into like, well, maybe it's he only chips well in certain grass types. I really think there's probably a little bit of a mental block with Cantlay in major championships. And he's a really good putter. So sometimes that in majors, you don't always have to be as great of a putter. The tee to green really needs to be there. So sometimes Cantlay might pop up in these wedge putting contests a little bit, and that might influence the way we think about him maybe a little more positively than we should, but he's a great player. I think there's probably a little mental block in majors.
Yeah, I think I agree with the mental block. Like, and I think, like, you know, if you a small question is like, is Max Homa a major player now? I think like in his career, he's shown that he struggles. Like he has to get like kind of like acclimated to his new level of golf, and it's kind of been this like up one step, down one step, up one step, down one step for Max, and seemingly he is now like cleared into where he believes he can play in major championships, which, you know, kind of happened. He joked about like finally having a good major championship last year at the Open. Like, finally I was like in the mix. People can say that, like, I, you know, I did this, and now he's back there again. I think like with Homa, that's like a clear like kind of evolution. But I agree, like Xander, one of the, you know, we got to know Xander at the Erin Hills U.S. Open. That's where he kind of burst on the scene, and he's always been around in majors. Patrick Cantlay's like kind of the opposite, where we got to know him winning the the Valspar might have been his first win. And you know, he kind of like, he came to us through winning PGA Tour events, not contending in majors.
Yeah, Xander, like, you could make a compelling argument that Xander Schauffele is the second best golfer in the world right now. And I think a lot of people would disagree with that. They'd say Ludvig, but like Xander's been pretty much top 10, like every week for the past 18 months. Not every week, but he's been extremely consistent. So I think adding a little pop this year, nobody should be surprised if he's in the mix at a major, but we'll see.
All right, let's do one more question from you.
Sure. Andy, who is the least predictable golfer in the world right now where you fully believe that if you saw him in the final group of a major, it wouldn't surprise you? And if he missed the cut by three, it also wouldn't surprise you. Who comes to mind?
Jordan Spieth.
Really? It wouldn't surprise you to see him in the final group. That's actually, this is not what I thought you were going to say.
Who's it for you?
For me, it's either Wyndham Clark or Colin Morikawa. I kind of feel like either of those guys could miss the cut or be in the final group, and I wouldn't be surprised. It's interesting to see that you're giving Spieth enough credit that he could be in the final group of a major this year.
I just think his game's insane. It's just all over the place. Could you see him contending at Pinehurst? I think so. I think that, like, or an Open, absolutely. Like, I think both those courses set up well for him. Like, you know, to steal Jeff Ogilvie's line from pod years ago, he said, if you put me in the middle of every fairway at Pinehurst with a wedge, I'd be happy if I walked away with 12 greens in regulation. Like, when that, you know, the tournament becomes really, like, you know, his iron play can be super elite. And when it becomes about, like, getting up and down, and I mean, talk about a Scottie Scheffler track. God, thinking about Pinehurst now, Scottie Scheffler, that could be a runaway. Cam Smith too. But yeah, you start to, like, Cam Smith would be another one that would be a great one for this list. Even though I feel like he's kind of flown under the radar of, like, how good he's been in majors.
He's been good.
Like, he's just like a top 10 machine in majors. And it's like, I mean, So anyways, I think, like, with Jordan, it's just like, I don't know what's coming out of the golf swing. You know, it's like true unpredictability. And from there, it just sets everything else off, right?
That's interesting. I like that answer. You might even be higher on Spieth's upside than I am at the moment, and that's your famous just a guy take. So interesting to hear you preach a little bit of Spieth optimism, although I understand the context of it being unpredictable.
So yours is Wyndham. I mean, Wyndham's had an unbelievable year.
He's in the mix at Harbortown, misses the cut at Augusta. Like, I kind of expect almost, like, I think Wyndham can kind of do anything. He missed the cut at Riv, which wasn't a hard cut to make with a small field. He's kind of all over the place, and then he pops up and you feel like he could legitimately win. So yeah, I think his range of outcomes is pretty wide each week.
I think you could argue that Wyndham would have two more wins this year if it wasn't for Scotty, because he would have won Bay Hill, and then I think he would have won this week because he made that run and he knew he had to just keep going bananas. And that could have led to the bogeys on the back nine, you know, where it's like, okay, I just went out in 29 and I need to shoot another 29 to catch Scotty.
Well, and Andy, we talked a few weeks ago about Colin Morikawa. Like, where is he? We haven't seen anything from him this year. Was in the mix at the Masters and then posted another good finish at the RBC Heritage. I think that's another player, though. Like, could miss the cut, could be top three. So yeah, those are the couple names that come to mind, but I like the Spieth call too.
All right, let's get to Meg and talk a little bit about Nelly Korda. But first, let's talk about our partner, Echo. Echo makes what I would say are the most comfortable golf shoes. I recently took them to Northern Ireland. I had not worn the pair that I got. I got the Eric Van Rooyen signature shoe. I had not worn it. I had not stepped, you know, taken, maybe I took one or two steps in them before that. That's usually a recipe for disaster. I was worried. I had just run a marathon. My legs weren't feeling great. I put these shoes on. I had no problems. They were comfortable. They were great. If anything, my feet felt the best of anything else on my legs after wearing brand new shoes and walking, you know, 18 plus every single day all over the place. I think I averaged like 22,000 steps a day for that trip. And the shoes were delightful. So the latest from Echo is the LT1. It's got a sneaker style design, modern design, but it's filled with all these like intricate design elements. And like what Echo really does better than everyone is technology, comfort, and design. So they're waterproof. They're available in laced and boa options. And like the big magic of these LT1s is the LYTR foam that is an advanced bounce and rebound material, which is embedded in the sole. That's what makes it feel like you're walking on a cloud. So you'll get done with 18 holes, and I guarantee you your feet won't hurt in these Echoes. Go to us.echo.com to shop for your next pair of golf shoes. All right, let's get to Meg on Chevron and Nelly Korda's dominance. All right, Meg, welcome on. I hope you had a great weekend watching the Chevron. Nelly Korda, 5 straight wins now. This is a historic mark. She joins Annika Sorenstam and Nancy Lopez as the only players to ever win 5 LPGA events in a row. Obviously capping it off, maybe not capping it off, continuing it with a major championship. Who knows? She might win again next week. What do you think is most impressive about Nelly's run?
Yeah, it's hard to say just one thing. I think, you know, it's a combination of things. And she's talked about that a little bit as, you know, she's had so many interviews as the streak has continued. But the big one, I think, is her health. You know, after that 2021 breakthrough, she gets the blood clot in 2022 and isn't even thinking about golf, like honestly, just trying to get herself healthy and get through that, which is a scary deal, obviously. And then kind of had, you know, a bum back for some of the year last year. And so the health is a big thing, but I don't mean to undermine the work that she's put in, because she's put in some serious work with her putter, and it's starting to show, you know, obviously in this streak. It's been great seeing her, you know, her lag putts this week were incredible. Everything was within like that 2-foot circle, no 3 putts. And I think that if you point to her game, you know, especially last year, that's what was lacking. And that's where kind of the focus went in the offseason. And, you know, barring, she had a really bad putting performance right out the gate, her first tournament of the year. But outside of that, she's been positive throughout this whole streak. I don't have, you know, I was refreshing KPMG Performance Insights this morning to see if they had updated yet. They haven't updated yet, so no numbers for this week at Chevron. But I'd be shocked if she wasn't positive there. So, yeah, it's when you get it, like I said in the newsletter, it's eerily familiar to Scotty, where, you know, all other aspects of the game are so high, and then if she doesn't need to be great with the putter, she just needs to, you know, not lose strokes, hover around average, and you know, I think she's 46 or something right now in putting. And yeah, that'll get her the wins that she's been getting.
Something that I heard on the telecast, which I thought was a great point, and I think maybe is the overlooked aspect of injuries in golf, is what it does to your like off-season rest time when you're rehabbing and you're unable to really have time off. Like you're playing or you're rehabbing. And they talked a little bit about how this was the first year that she's had an off season in a while since 2021. And it just gave her a little bit of time to reset. And here she comes out gangbusters, obviously very clearly the best woman in the world. And it's, you know, I'm excited to see where it goes from here. A lot like the men's schedule, things are super condensed, and we're going to have a bunch of major championships. There's 5 of them here. She's up to 13 wins. Like, I think like going into this year at age 25, you could kind of look at Nelly Korda's career. She had 1 win, and she had, 8 wins, 1 major, 8 wins. And you kind of thought, I feel like this should be more.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you blink, and now it's 2 majors, 13 wins. It's a wild kind of run.
It's an incredible run. You know, it's been so you know, so fast these 5 weeks in a row. It's like you're trying to just get into context just what she's doing and how rare and how fabulous it's been. And it's you're totally right there. She spoke to just the past 2 years, just never feeling like she could catch up to where she needed to be with that time up. when that time off and a normal off season, you know, spent improving, and then the break to travel and skip the Asian swing, just, you know, looking back, that just looks so smart and primed her for this run here.
Meg, you've already hit on this a little bit in talking about Nelly's putting. I heard her mention that her putting wasn't as strong, and then it's kind of turned around, and you're kind of alluding to Scottie Scheffler, such a great ball striker. If only he could putt average, he'd start winning, and then he starts winning. I'm curious if you could kind of paint a portrait of Nelly Korda's career and her statistical profile in her young career. Is it accurate to depict her as an elite ball striker that struggled with the putter and now that's turned on? I mean, how would you characterize the beginning of her career?
Yeah, I will paint as best as LPGA statistics let me paint. It'll be more of like a finger paint job here. But you know, looking at KPMG Performance Insights, not to, you know, make fun of it at all, that there's been great strides in the past couple years there. So that only goes back though for like full strokes gained stats 2 years. So 2022 and 2023 are what we're talking about here. Justin Ray kind of works off a much larger database for majors, but it's not full season stuff here. But you know, the past 2022 and 2023, she kind of always hovered around a full stroke gained off the tee. And you know, if you've paid attention, you know, that's, you know, if you've seen the many videos of her swing and her drives, like that's her strength. She's powerful, she's long, she's accurate. Not to be like, the putting has improved, but her approach play is also hovering this year around a full stroke, which was not the case the past 2 years. So you're seeing, you know, the driving hasn't fallen off at all. You're seeing just her raise the other areas where she wasn't as strong. I mentioned the putting, kind of that outlier tournament at the start, the Hilton Garden Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions, very long title. Besides that, you know, if the data comes out for Chevron and she's positive stroke gained putting again, that's five tournaments positive. Last year she had 10 total where she was positive with strokes gained putting. So we're halfway there. It's not even May. And I think what goes hand in hand with putting and putting back to back weeks together, like Nelly's done, is the confidence. And she's super confident with the flat stick right now. She hasn't fallen off in the other areas. She's raised her approach play, and that's why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah, I think like one of the other, you know, undertones is Lydia Ko's kind of having another really good year, rebound year after a disappointing year last year. She's putting together a wonderful year, and Nelly's still a half a shot better per round according to strokes gained, which, you know, it's not quite as big as the Scheffler Gulf, which is like almost a full shot, but it is, it's an extraordinary, you know, they played about 20 rounds. So it's a huge number. It's not a huge number, but it's a meaningful sample size, to be outpacing in another elite player like Lydia Ko. I think like one of the things that, in sports, obviously, Caitlin Clark mania swept the world, and women's sports as a total had this really great moment. I'm curious, from your perspective, I think the Chevron is kind of, obviously it's the old Dinosaur, but it's not the Dinosaur. You know, it is this new major, and with women's sports really popping, you know, and obviously Caitlin Clark, I think, is an outlier. I think people are kind of thinking like, oh, this is going to do this and this and this. From your perspective, do you think Nelly elevated the Chevron? Does it feel more like a major because of this achievement and this win? And furthermore, what you think the LPGA needs to do better in order to put themselves in a situation where the sport can be embraced like Caitlin, not maybe at Caitlin Clark's level, but at a, you know, where it has the potential to pop.
Yeah, she certainly helped with the Chevron. And I, you know, I've been blunt about how, you know, the move and losing the history of the Dinosaur, You can't just, you know, pop it in another part of the country on a tournament that nobody has ever heard of before, or at a course that nobody's ever heard of before, and say, yep, here we go, first major of the year. It doesn't work. But credit where credit is due. They raised the purse. They signed on through 2029. You know, big time charity aspect was the birdies at 17. So donating over like $1.5 million from that. So they're doing the things, but it takes time. It's not an overnight thing. But, you know, the best player in the world, getting her second major and continuing her streak, it certainly helps. To the broader, you know, discussion around women's sports and everything, my struggle, and this is, it's nothing new, and I wasn't surprised by the lack of pop in the broadcast yesterday and how it didn't feel major, because golf and women's golf in particular, with the media rights deal, women's golf is set up to be always the bridesmaid, never the bride. You know, that's how this is structured with this media rights deal, with the LPGA being the tag along to the overall, the bigger deal with the PGA Tour. Listen, hindsight's always 2020. I think at the time when that was signed, you know, it was before Molly Marcus-Simon has come on. This was Mike Wan. Women's sports and the LPGA was in a much different state. And this was better than what they had. I don't think anybody could have foreseen how quickly women's sports has grown and now having this moment. But where I get frustrated is the inflexibility of not putting, you know, the completion of round three on Golf Channel. Not, you know, it's I get, but then again, what do you expect? Like, you're the tag along, that you're not under the official PGA Tour umbrella. Korn Ferry Tour is. Champions Tour is. LPGA isn't. And again, credit to the LPGA and Molly Marcus-Simon for paying for ESPN Plus streaming coverage for this tournament. That's really, as far as I understand, the one area where the LPGA can branch out on its own. This deal goes through 2030. So unless something changes and they make a bold move and get out of the contract somehow and go to ESPN, which I think has become the leader in, you know, women's sports, advancing the coverage from what they've done with NCAA tournament. They're part of the big deal for the NWSL's new media rights deal. If there was ever a time to do it, it would be now, with not only with what Nelly's doing, but with where women's sports is. But the major frustration to me is the inflexibility. And, you know, Nelly Korda is not a bridesmaid. The players deserve better. Not only Nelly Korda, but all the other world-class athletes in that on that tour deserve better.
Yeah, I think like something that's kind of interesting is that for a year plus now, there's been a lot of rumors about NBC kind of wanting to shutter Golf Channel and move it all under this NBC Sports umbrella. And yet when we hit golf season, there's not enough space to broadcast all the golf, and somebody always loses out. And, you know, if you bump the Champions Tour, that's the most logical, because 65-year-olds usually aren't on Twitter yelling about it. but when you've got all the tours playing, there's not enough space. And I agree with you with like ESPN. I think like one of the things that with everybody is yelling for more coverage, and I don't necessarily agree. In terms of like more coverage on Golf Channel, I think you hit the nail on the head with ESPN. To me, a women's golf audience doesn't exist in the current, you know, like growth in women's golf audience doesn't exist in the current golf audience. I think the easiest way for women's golf to grow is to get exposed to new audience, which is what ESPN will do so well. Like, golf skews older, and I think where we saw the Caitlin Clark wave of rush of excitement came from people that are generally under 40 years old. And I don't know, like, how many of those people, you know, are you're reaching with Golf Channel. Like, it's, you know, we're for under 40 audience is like the cord cutting generation. And I think, like, when I look at like what the LPGA, you know, beyond just like looking at, oh, this is their fault. Like, I think the LPGA needs to look itself in the mirror and also say, what are things we could do to help us? I mean, YouTube should be a huge priority for them. Getting highlights of rounds up, having a show on there that dives into these things. These should all be ideas in order to grow their audience. Showcasing the extraordinary talents in other formats beyond just relying on the, you know, broadcast partners. You know, why don't we have these like nine hole matches, different things that show off personality and talent and skills of these women? To me, this is not it's the easy thing to do is to yell at the broadcast partners. I do think the LPGA has not done itself any favors from in terms of the way they market and message their tour. And I think that's really when they do a better job talking about themselves, the broadcast partners will do a better job showcasing these talent.
Yeah, you're right. And I look back at when the transition from Mike Wan to Molly Marcoussimon happened, and Molly took a lot of time to learn and listen and figure out this new role. But that also happened to be when this push in women's sports began. And, you know, you look at some of the other leagues and they've, you know, captured and they've been the front runners on this. And I don't want the LPGA to miss this ride and to miss out on what's going on. There, you know, to their credit, I don't think a marketing department even existed prior to this year. Social media has been much better. They have an LPGA Insider podcast that just launched this week. So there are baby steps, but this is kind of the time when other sports are making leaps, and it's time for the LPGA to make some leaps. The history has been to kind of follow in line with what the PGA Tour does, but in a smaller scale. And it's time to break off of that and do your own thing, get to a new audience. You know, there's so many different things they can do. And I think, yes, the progress is happening, but it's kind of baby steps here and there. And it's time for a bigger leap.
Meg, I think one thing that struck me from watching, you know, I don't watch women's golf every single week. It's hard to watch and cover both the PGA Tour and the LPGA Tour. That's an ongoing struggle. But it did strike me. I'm curious how big of an issue you think pace of play is, because it was a 6-hour final round. And like Andy's mentioning, some of the things that could potentially spruce up, grow the game, not to use a cliche term, outside of just blaming the broadcast. Curious if you think that's a significant area of improvement, because as I was watching the broadcast, it did feel slow, not just because it was 6 hours. There weren't graphics. It wasn't as interactive. In terms of capturing a younger audience, is pace of play somewhere maybe we should start?
Yeah, I mean, it was brutal. It was brutal. It was a hard, hard watch, which just stinks for what was going on and how big of a moment it should have been. Yeah, pace of play is an issue. And, you know, when NBC broadcasts PGA Tour events, you know, it can be a tough watch. And they've got probably triple the amount of people on site, probably triple the amount of cameras, advanced graphics, stats, storytelling, so on and so forth. So you take all that away, and yeah, you're going to get a really tough watch. And, you know, I don't want that to be like, yeah, the announcers stink, the broadcasters stink. Could they be better? Sure. Like Karen Stupples provides great insight. She's very, very, very good, but she can't carry. She's the only one on the course. She can't carry that on her own. The camera, you know, when Nelly hit it in the water on 15, it was commercial, her tee shot, a blurry, I don't know if it was a drone overhead shot that you couldn't see the ball, if the ball went in or went out, you know, a pivotal moment on, did she just rinse one on this back stretch, or is she on dry land? And go to commercial, we're going to find out where that ball ended up when we get back. And it's like, oh, it's tough.
It's a cliffhanger. That's like your favorite TV show, right?
Yeah. A little cliffhanger there for everybody that was tuning in that, you know, maybe some didn't come back after that lengthy commercial break. Pace of play, Joseph, 2 year, it's an issue. And it, you know, Nelly hates slow play, hates it. So for her to, you know, get through that marathon day, she also, like, I don't mean to throw Jennifer Song under the bus, but like Jennifer Song in the first 2 days got thrown in, her group when Lily Avu withdrew. And I mean, she was DFL, I think 81-81. So like maybe Nelly was used to, you know, some slow play and some struggles from the first 2 days that helped her on the weekend. But she talked about how, you know, she slows down her routine when she knows it's going to be a long day. And that's not what should happen. She shouldn't have to change her process and her routine because of what's going on around her. I was hoping for the announcer to say like some other group had been put on the clock, something was happening. And nothing happened, which is, it's pretty unfortunate. I think that's a way that many of us diehards would give a be very excited if slow play was enforced out there. But yeah, it didn't happen. It's brutal. And when you throw that in with a broadcast that doesn't have the resources they need, it's a combination for people who want to be interested and watch to lose interest and turn it off.
On the ground, at last year's US Women's Open, I don't have any like hard data, supporting this, but to me, it just felt slower in person. Than men's professional golf, which is by no means an example setter. They're slow, but it felt a little bit slower than that to me. And I think that's the other thing. The TV product is not great, but the in-person product is not great either because of how slow it is. You don't like, it's hard to be engaged and interested when pre-shot routines are taking 2 minutes. Like there's this human, and I think like what you've illuminated with the product deficiencies on television, lack of cameras, lack of people, what happens is you end up hanging on these pre-shot routines for longer because there's nothing to go to. And when that happens, it just slows everything down. And I think of all the formats of golf, I think the women's game should be the most aggressive in attacking this because they have the most leverage, in my opinion, to attack it. They could have a great TV product if they could just get all, like if they, you know, if all the tours, it'd probably be the easiest to put in play some sort of shot clock.
Yeah, they're following the same formula that the PGA Tour does, but with not as many resources. And this is when they need to zag when others are zigging and do something different, whether that's slow play. Like the other, you know, overarching theme here is the LPGA has been gifted the greatest competitive advantage it's ever had with what's happened on the men's side of things with the split in LIV and PGA and it, you know, not all of the stars being playing week in, week out. The LPGA has that. All their stars are there. Their schedule isn't as bloated. So, you know, they're
they almost play every week.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we have these signature events on the PGA Tour people get excited for. That's almost every week on the LPGA Tour.
Yeah. And that's where I'm going with, like, all the stars are aligning with everything that's going on, from the competitive advantage of having all your stars there, from what's going on in women's sports, from Nelly, the superstar you've been waiting for, emerging, and you cannot miss the boat. You got to capitalize in a big way, not the small things, not, you know, an extra $2 million in the purse, not, you know, adding a tournament here or there. Like it's got to be big change. And yeah, if there was ever time to kind of break away from Big Brother PGA Tour, it's now.
Yeah, I agree. So let's get you out of here with a couple quickies here.
Right.
Over under 7.5 wins for Nelly this year.
That's so many.
She's so at
many.
5.
That's so many. God, I always go under on this stuff, but what the hell? Let's go over, because she just looks so confident, more confident than we've ever seen her. And I think she's realizing, you know, how freaking good she is and what she can do. And I'm saying over too, because I want to see her win at St. Andrews. I think it'd be massive, probably the biggest stage. You know, Pebble was huge last year. That St. Andrews is it this year. Getting a third major, and then, you know, you throw in two others there. Maybe, maybe that gets you over 7.5.
All right. Over under, does she end the year with, does she get another major? You're saying St. Andrews. I guess that's the question. Does she?
Yeah, I'm going to give her that. And then let's say she gets a medal at the Olympics. Let's count that as a win. Deal?
That's one of the other great things about women's golf is like the Olympics is like a much bigger achievement.
Huge. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a stage that is such a bigger deal for them than the men. That exposure is such a huge deal.
And then outside of St. Andrews, what event are you most looking forward to on the calendar?
It's Solheim Cup. I know that's kind of cheating, but it's not, you know, 72 hole stroke play, but
Might be why you're interested in
exactly
it.
Right. Yeah. There you go. But having two over the course of 2 years with the women getting back on the even year schedule, it's stateside this year. I think it's, you know, gearing up to be another good one. It was like, talk about bad broadcasts. Like, you think yesterday was bad? That Solheim Cup broadcast was probably worse. But I had so much fun watching it. Maybe that says something about me, but it was incredible, you know, incredible stretch down there at the end when the Euros nipped us. But yeah, Solheim Cup should be great, a great time this year.
All right. Thank you, Meg. Everybody can follow your writing on thefriedegg.com through the newsletter, but also they can follow you on social media. What's your handle?
Meg_Adkins_TFE.
All right. Thanks, Meg.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Thanks, Meg.
All right. Big thanks to Meg for coming on and joining us. Joseph, let's get to recommendations. Do you have a recommendation?
I do. I kind of like this one. It's made a little bit of an impact on me already. So, Andy, I don't know anything about menswear, men's fashion. I don't think I dress particularly well, something I need to improve upon. Found a Twitter account recently. It's a pretty popular one. And it's the guy's name is Derek Guy. And it's at Dye Workwear, D-I-E. And he does like commentary around celebrity outfits. It's specifically pretty tailored to men's fashion, no pun intended. But like the bow tie here, the ends of it should line up with the outside of your eyes a little more. Like he does this analysis of tailoring, how suits look on people. I found it to be interesting. It's something I know nothing about. And I'd recommend it for either yourself or a significant other. Somebody needs to improve the way they dress or just interested in analysis of it. I've gotten a lot of value out of it already. It's a huge account. Has like 800,000 followers.
Look at this. All right. I didn't know about this. I might subscribe here. I might sign up with a follow. I've been trying to be judicious of my follows, even though Twitter and X just feeds me a bunch of crap that I don't want now. But anyways, we could see that maybe that will be the next out segment next week. Will be Twitter completely. my recommendation, and I saw this happening last week in Augusta. There were a good amount of people that used the Masters as an opportunity to make an Aiken golf trip. And I think this is one of the great golf trips that you can make. People complain all the time about private clubs not opening their doors, golf being exclusive. Aiken has four extraordinarily good golf courses. They have, you know, Palmetto, Tree Farm, Old Barnwell and Aiken Golf Club. Aiken Golf Club being very affordable. Tree Farm, Old Barnwell, and Palmetto, you're going to pay during the week of the Masters, but they are all open, and we're accepting guest play every day. I saw a couple people that made this trip. They played Palmetto, Old Barnwell, and Tree Farm, and a few tagged on Aiken Golf Club. That's one of the best golf trips that you can make in America. So if you have Masters tickets or you don't have Masters tickets, there is a reason to go to the area. I think there will be another one opening next spring called Broomsedge, which is a Kyle France design. That will be a little bit further away. It'll be like about 45 minutes to an hour from Aiken area. But you can go have a world-class golf trip in Aiken the week of the Masters. And you don't have to go to the Masters. You could just go play golf. And there, I think that the golf will range you about $500 per stop. It's not cheap, but it is really, really good. And for $500, it's better than going to like Kohler for 3 days or something.
I visited the area for a fried egg event last fall, and I feel like the only part that you maybe left out there is it was an amazing golf experience. But downtown Aiken's also really cool. Like, there's some cool stops, like cool restaurants. We went to some old hotel, historic hotel, to get drinks. Like, it's a cool place to hang out after your round. So I totally would co-sign that.
Yeah, they have polo matches every weekend too. My wife and I went to a polo match a few years ago. It was delightful. It was like the day. I think it was a Sunday after one of our events at Aiken Golf Club. So they have polo on the weekends too. But yeah, I think that trip is amazing for the Masters. I saw there were a couple people doing it. Like, they got in on like the Sunday before, and they were playing, or Saturday before. They played Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So a neat little way to do a really good golf trip. All right, that does it for today's episode. We will be back later this week with another episode. In the meantime, check out our events. They're all open for public consumption. Anybody can register. We've got some really, really great golf courses. You're going to be at the event at Lookout Mountain at the end of the month. Is there one that you're looking at that you wish you could attend that you're currently not slated to attend right now?
Maybe all of them. Chambers Bay stands out as one that I can't believe I'm not going to be there. I think it's in the end of July.
It's the day after the Pacific Coast Amateur.
Right. Like, I've never even been to Seattle. It's an amazing city. You guys are playing it at like a perfect time of the year to be playing it. Chambers Bay stands out to me as one that I really can't believe I'm missing.
I'm going to try and get up to that one because I haven't been to Seattle either. I would really like to go. I've also heard that from a price standpoint, 36 holes at Chambers Bay, it's a really good deal peak season. So that is one that I would second. That is going to be a great event, and I might be up there. Maybe you'll be up there. Who knows? I do need to get to Seattle. All right. Big thanks to Matt Ruches for editing, producing this podcast, and we'll be back later this week with another episode of the Friday Golf Podcast. Thank you.